The Clear Blue Seas of Luna by Gregory Benford. You know many things, but what he knows is both less and more than what I tell to us. Or especially what we all tell to all those others, those simple humans who are like him in their limits. I cannot be what you are, you the larger. Not that we are not somehow also the same, wedded to our memories of the centuries we have been wedded and grown together. For we are like you and him and I, a life form that evolution could not produce in the rich loam of earth. To birth forth and then burst forth a thing, a great sprawling metallo-bio-cyber thing such as we and you, takes grander musics, such as I know. Only by shrinking down to the narrow chasms of the single view can you know the intricate slick fineness, the reek and tingle and chime of this silky symphony of self. But bigness blunders, thumb-fingered. Smallness can enchant. So let us go, an oddment of him and me and you. He saw a long, thin, hard room, fluorescent white, without shadows. Metal, on ceramo glass, on fake wood, on woven nylon rug. A granite desk. A man whose name he could not recall. A neat uniform so familiar he looked beyond it by reflex. He felt light gravity. Mars? The moon? Rough cloth at a cuff of his work shirt. A chill, dry, air-conditioned breeze along his neck. A red flash of anger. Benjon smiled slightly. He had just seen what he must do. "Gray was free when we began work centuries ago," Benjon said, his black eyes fixed steadily on the man across the desk. "Katonji, that was the man's name. His commander, once, a very long time ago."
"It had been planned that way, yes,"
his superior said haltingly, begrudging the words.
"That was the only reason I took the assignment," Benjon said.
"I know. Unfortunately, I have spent many decades on it."
"Fleet control certainly appreciates. Worldscaping isn't a job, dammit. It's an art, a discipline, a craft that saps a man's energies."
"And you have done quite well. Personally, I..."
"When you asked me to do this, I wanted to know what fleet control planned for Gray."
"You can recall an ancient conversation?"
"A verbal maneuver, no more." Katonji was an amplified human and already well over 2 centuries old. But the Earthside's social convention was to pretend that the past faded away, leaving a young psyche.
"A grand experiment in human society, I remember your words."
"True, that was the original plan. But now you tell me a single faction needs it? The whole moon?"
"The council has reconsidered."
"Reconsidered? Hell."
Benjon's brawn face crinkled with disdain.
"Somebody pressured them, and they gave in. Who was it?"
"I would not put it that way," said Katonji coldly. "I know you wouldn't. Far easier to hide behind words."
He smiled wryly and compressed his thin lips. The viewscreen near him looked out on a cold silver landscape, and he studied it, smoldering inside. An artificial viewscape from Gray itself. Earth, a crescent concerto in blue and white, hung in a creamy sky over the insect working of robo-tractors and men. Gray's air was unusually clear today, the normal haze swept away by a front blowing in from the equator near Mare Crisium. The milling minions were hollowing out another cavern for fleet control to fill with cubicles and screens and memos. Great gray above, mere gray below. Earth swam above high fleecy cirrus, and for a moment Benjon dreamed of the day when birds, easily adapted to the light gravity and high atmospheric density, would flap lazily across such views.
"Officer Tozenji, I am no longer an officer. I resigned before you were born. By your leave, I meant it solely as an honorific. Surely you still have some loyalty to the fleet?"
Benjon laughed. The deep bass notes echoed from the office walls with a curious emptiness.
So it's an appeal to the honor of the crest, is it? I see I spent too long on Gray. Back here you have forgotten what I am like,
Benjon said. But where is here? I could not take Earth full gravity anymore, so this must be an orbiting fleet cylinder, spinning gravity. A frown.
I had hoped that working once more with fleet officers would change you, even though you remained a civilian on Gray. A man isn't...
A man is what he is, Benjon said.
Ketanji leaned back in his shift chair and made a tent of his fingers.
You played the Sabal game during those years?
He asked slowly. Benjon's eyes narrowed.
Yes, I did.
The game was ancient, revered, simplicity itself. It taught that the greater gain lay in working with others rather than in self-seeking. He had always enjoyed it, but only a fool believed that such moral lessons extended to the cut and thrust of fleet matters.
It did not bring you to community?
I got on well enough with the members of my team,
Benjon said evenly.
I hoped such isolation with a small group would calm your spirit. Fleet is a community of men and women seeking enlightenment in the missions, just as you do. You are an exceptional person, anchored as you are in the station, using linkages we have not used.
Permitted, you mean?
Those old techniques were deemed too risky.
Benjon felt his many links like a background hum, in concert and warm. What could this man know of such methods, time savored by those who lived them?
And not easy to direct from above.
The man fastidiously raised a finger and persisted.
We still sit at the game, and while you are here, we would welcome your...
Can we leave my spiritual progress aside?
Of course, if you desire.
Fine. Now tell me, who is getting my planet?
Gray is not your planet.
I speak for the station and all the intelligences who link with it. We made Gray. Through many years, we hammered the crust, released the gases, planted the spores, damped the winds. With help. 300 of us at the start, and 11 heavy spacecraft. A puny beginning that blossomed into millions. Helped by the entire staff of Earthside. They were fleet men. They take orders. I don't. I work by contract.
A contract spanning centuries?
It is still valid, though those who wrote it are dust.
Let us treat this in a gentlemanly fashion, sir. Any contract can be renegotiated.
The paper I am here to speak for all, signed for Gray, said it was to be an open colony. That's the only reason I worked on it,
he said sharply.
I would not advise you to pursue that point, Ketanji said.
He turned and studied the viewscreen, his broad southern Chinese nose flaring at the nostrils. But the rest of his face remained an impassive mask. For a long moment there was only the thin whine of air circulation in the room.
Sir,
the other man said abruptly,
I can only tell you what the Council has granted. Men of your talents are rare. We know that had you undertaken the formation of Gray for a private interest, you would have demanded more payment.
Wrong! I wouldn't have done it at all.
Nonetheless, the Council is willing to pay you a double fee. The Magican clan, who have been invested with primacy rights to Gray,
what?
Have seen fit to contribute the amount necessary to reimburse you.
So that's who?
And all others of the station to whom I have been authorized to release funds immediately.
Benjon stared blankly ahead for a short moment.
I believe I'll do a bit of releasing myself,
he murmured, almost to himself.
What?
Oh, nothing.
Information?
Oh.
The clans have a stronghold on the Council, but not the 3D. People might be interested to know how it came about that a new planet, a rich one, too, was handed over.
Officer Tozinji.
Best to pause, think. He shrugged, tried on a thin smile. I was only jesting. Even idealists are not always stupid. I am glad of that. Lodge the Magican draft in my account. I want to wash my hands of this. The other man said something, but Benjon was not listening. He made the ritual of leaving. They exchanged only perfunctory hand gestures. He turned to go and wondered at the naked, flat room this man had chosen to work in. It carried no soft tones, no humanity, none of the feel of a room that is used, a place where men do work that interests them, so that they embody it with something of themselves. This office was empty in the most profound sense. It was a room for men who lived by taking orders. He hoped never to see such a place again. Benjon turned, stepped, the slow slide of falling, then catching himself. Stepped. You fall over gray, skating down the steep banks of young clouds, searching, driving. Luna you know as gray, as all in station know it, because pearly clouds deck high in its thick air. It had been gray long before, as well, the aged pewter of rock hard-hammered for billions of years by the relentless sun. Now its air was like soft slate, cloaking the greatest of human handiworks. You raise a hand and gaze at it. So much could come from so small an instrument. You marvel. A small tool, five-fingered slab, working over great stretches of centuries. Seen against the canopy of your craft, it seems an unlikely tool to heft worlds with. And the thought alone sends you plunging. Luna was born small, too small. So the sun had readily stripped it of its early shroud of gas. Luna came from the collision of a Mars-sized world into the primordial Earth. From that colossal crunch, how you wish you could have seen that. Spun a disk, and from that churn, Luna condensed, red-hot. The heat of that birth stripped away the moon's water and gases, leaving it bare to the sun's glower. So amend that. You steer a comet from the chilly freezer beyond Pluto, swing it around Jupiter and smack it into the bleak fields of Mare Crisium. In bits. For a century, all hell breaks loose. You wait, patient in your station. It is a craft of fractions. Luna is smaller, so needs less to build an atmosphere. There was always some scrap of gas on the moon, trapped from the solar wind, baked from its dust, perhaps even belched from the early, now long-dead volcanoes. When Apollo descended, bringing the first men, its tiny exhaust plume doubled the mass of the frail atmosphere. Still, such a wan world could hold gases for tens of thousands of years. Physics said so. Its lesser gravity tugs at a mere sixth of Earth's hefty grip. So to begin, you sling inward a comet bearing a third the mass of all Earth's ample air, a chunk of mountain-sized, grimy ice. Sol's heat had robbed this world, but Mother Massive Earth herself had slowly stolen away its spin. It became a submissive partner in a rigid gavotte, forever tide-locked with one face always smiling at its partner. Here you use the ice-toroid to double effect. By hooking the comet adroitly around Jupiter, in a reverse swing-by, you loop it into an orbit opposite the customary, docile way that worlds loop around the sun. Go opposite. Retro. Coming in on Luna, the ice ball then has 10 times the impact energy. Mere days before it strikes, you blow it apart with meticulous brutality. Smashed to shards, chunks come gliding in all around Luna's equator, small enough that they cannot muster momentum enough to splatter free of gravity's grip. Huge cannonballs slam into gray rock,
but at angles that prevent them from getting away again. Earth Admin was picky about this. No debris was to be flung free to rain down as celestial buckshot on that favored world. Within hours, Luna had air of a crude sort. You mixed and salted and worked your chemical magics upon roiling clouds that sported forked lightning. Gravity's grind provoked fevers, molecular riots. More, as the pellets pelted down, Luna spun up. Its crust echoed with myriad slams and bangs. The old world creaked as it yielded, spinning faster from the hammering. From its lazy cycle of 28 days, it sped up to 60 hours, close enough to Earth-like, as they say, for government work. A day still lazy enough. Even here you orchestrated a nuanced performance, coaxed from dynamics. Luna's axial tilt had been a dull zero. Dutifully, it had spun at right angles to the orbital plane of the solar system, robbed of summers and winters. But you wanted otherwise. Angled just so, the incoming ice nuggets tilted the poles. From such simple mechanics you conjured seasons. And as the gases cooled, icy caps crowned your work. You were democratic. At first, allowing both water and carbon dioxide with smidges of methane and ammonia. Here you called upon the appetites of bacteria, sprites you sowed as soon as the winds calmed after bombardment. They basked in sunlight, broke up the methane. The greenhouse blanket quickly warmed the old gray rocks, coveting the heat from the infalls, and soon algae covered them. You watched with pride as the first rain fell. For centuries, the dark plains had carried humanity's imposed watery names: tranquility, serenity, crises, clouds, storms. Now these lowlands of aged lava caught the rains and made muds and fattened into ponds, lakes, true seas. You made the ancient names come true. Through your servant machines, you marched across these suddenly murky lands, bristling with an earned arrogance. They, yourself, plowed and dug, sampled and salted. Through their eyes and tongues and ears you sat in your high station and heard the sad baby sigh of the first winds awakening. The station was becoming more than a bristling canister of metal. By then, its agents grew, as did you. You smiled down upon the gathering gray with your quartz eyes and microwave antennas. For you knew what was coming. A mere sideways glance at rich Earth told you what to expect. Like Earth's tropics now, at Luna's equator, heat drove moist gases aloft. Cooler gas flowed from the poles to fill in. The high wet clouds skated poleward, cooled, and rained down riches. On Earth, such currents are robbed of their water about a third of the way to the poles, and so descend their dry rasp, making a worldwide belt of deserts. Not so on Luna. You had judged the streams of newborn air rightly. Thicker airs than Earth's took longer to exhaust, and so did not fall until they reached the poles. Thus the New World had no chain of deserts, and one simple circulating air cell ground away in each hemisphere. Moisture worked its magics. You smiled to see your labors come right. Though anchored in your mammoth station, you felt the first pinpricks of awareness in the crawlers, flyers, and diggers who probed the freshening moon. You tasted their flavors, the brimming possibilities. Northerly winds swept the upper half of the globe, bearing poleward, then swerving toward the west to make the occasional mild tornado. Not all weather should be boring. Clouds patrolled the air, still fretting over their uneasy berths. Day and night came in their slow rhythm, stirring the biological lab that worked below. You sometimes took a moment from running all this just to watch. Lunascapes. Great gray world. Where day yielded to dark, valleys sank into smoldering blackness. Already a chain of snowy peaks shone where they caught the sun's dimming rays and lit the plains with slanting colors like live coals. Sharp mountains cleaved the cloud banks, leaving a wake like that of a huge ship. At the fat equator, straining still to adjust to the new spin, tropical thunderheads glowered, lit by orange lightning that seemed to be looking for a way to spark life among the drifting molecules. All that you did in a mere decade. You had made the lesser light that rules the night now shine 5 times brighter, casting sharp shadows on Earth. Sun rays glinted by day from the young oceans, dazzling the eyes on Earth. And the Mother World itself reflected in those muddy seas so that when the alignment was right, people on Earth's night side gazed up into their own mirrored selves. Viewed at just the right angle, Earth's image was rimmed with ruddy sunlight, refracting through Earth's air. You knew it could not last, but were pleased to find that the new air stuck around. It would bleed away in 10,000 years. But by that time, other measures would come into play. You had plans for a monolayer membrane to cap your work, resting atop the whole atmosphere, the largest balloon ever conceived. Later? No, act in the moment, and so you did. You wove it with membrane skill, cast it wide, let it fall, to rest easy on the thick airs below. Great holes in it let ships glide to and fro, but the losses from those would be trivial. Not that all was perfect. Luna had no soil, only the damaged dust left from 4 billion years beneath the solar wind's anvil. After a mere momentary decade, nothing to you, fresh wonders bloomed. Making soil from gritty grime was work best left to the micro-beasts who loved such stuff. To do great works on a global scale took tiny assistance. You fashioned them in your own labs, which poked outward from the station's many-armed skin. Gray grew a crust. Earth is, in essence, a tissue of microbial organisms living off the sun's fires. Gray would do the same in Fast Forward. You cooked up not mere primordial broths, but endless chains of regulatory messages. Intricate feedback loops, organic gavats. Earth hung above, an example of life ornamented by elaborate decorations, structures of forest and grass and skin and blood, living quarters like seagrass and zebras and eucalyptus and primates. Do the same, you told yourself, only better. These tasks you loved. Their conjuring consumed more decades, stacked end on end. You were sucked into the romance of tiny turf wars, chemical assaults, microbial murders, and invasive incests. But you had to play upon the stellar stage as well. You had not thought about the tides. Even you had not found a way around those outcomes of gravity's gradient. Earth raised bulges in Gray's seas a full 20 meters tall. That made for a dim future for coastal property, even once the air became breathable. Luckily, even such colossal tides were not a great bother to the lakes you shaped in crater beds. These you made as breeding farms for the bioengineered minions who ceaselessly tilled the dirts, massaged the gases, filtered the tinkling streams that cut swift ways through rock. Indeed, here and there, you even found use for the tides. There were more watts lurking there in kinetic energy. You fashioned push plates to tap some of it to run your substations. Thrifty gods do not have to suck up to and from Earthside. And so the sphere that, when you began, had been the realm of strip miners and mass driver camps, of rugged, suited loners, became a place where, someday, humans might walk and breathe free. That time is about to come. You yearn for it. For you too can then manifest yourself, your station, as a mere mortal, and set foot upon a world that you would name Selene. You were both station and more by then. How much more few knew.
but some sliver of you clung to the name of Benjan.
Benjan nodded slightly, ears ringing for some reason. The smooth, sure interviewer gave a short introduction.
Man or manifestation? This we must all wonder at as we greet an embodiment of humanity's greatest and now ancient construction project. One you and I can see every evening in the sky, for those who are still surface dwellers.
The 3D cameras moved in smooth arcs through the studio darkness beyond. Two men sat in a pool of light. The interviewer spoke toward the directional mic as he gave the background on Benjan's charges against the council. Smiles galore, platitudes aplenty. That done, came the attack.
"But isn't this a rather abstract, distant point to bring at this time?"
the man said, turning to Benjan. Benjan blinked, uncertain, edgy. He was a private man, used to working alone. Now that he was moving against the council, he had to bear these public appearances, these manifestations of a dwindled self.
To the people of the next generation, gray will not be an abstraction.
You mean the moon?
Yes, gray is my name for it. That's the way it looked when we started work on it centuries ago.
Yes, you were there all along, in fact.
Well, yes. But when we're done...
Benjan leaned forward, and his interviewer leaned back as if not wanting to be too close.
It will be a real place, not just an idea. Where you all can live and start a planned ecology. It will be a frontier.
We understand that romantic tradition, but...
No, you don't. Gray isn't just an idea. It's something we've worked on for everyone. Whatever shape or gene type they might favor.
Yes, yes. And such ideas are touching in their, well, customary way, but...
But the only ones who will ever enjoy it, if the council gets away with this, is the Magikan clan.
The interviewer pursed his lips. Or was this a he at all? In the current style, the bulging muscles and thick neck might just be fashion statements.
Well, the Magikan are a very large, important segment of the...
No more important than the rest of humanity, in my estimation.
But to cause this much stir over a world that will not even be habitable for at least decades more...
We of the station are there now.
You've been modified, adapted.
Well, yes, I couldn't do this interview on Earth. I'm grav-adapted.
Frankly, that's why many feel we need to put Earthside people on the ground on Luna as soon as possible. To represent our point of view.
Look, Gray's not just any world. Not just a gas giant, useful for raw gas and nothing else. Not a Mercury type. There are millions of those littered out among the stars. Gray is going to be fully Earth-like. The astronomers tell us there are only 4 semi-terrestrials outside the home system that humans can ever live on, around other stars, and those are pretty terrible.
You forget the outer colonies.
The interviewer broke in smoothly, smiling at the 3D.
Yeah, ice balls.
He could not hide his contempt. What he wanted to say, but knew it was terribly old-fashioned, was,
damn it. Gray is happening now. We've got to plan for it. Photosynthesis is going on. I've seen it myself. Hell, I caused it myself. Carbon dioxide and water converting into organics and oxygen. Gases, fresh as a breeze. Currents carry the algae down through the cloud layers into the warm areas, where they work just fine. That gives off simple carbon compounds, raw carbon and water. This keeps the water content of the atmosphere constant, but converts carbon dioxide, we've got too much right now, into carbon and oxygen. It's going well. The rate itself is exponentiating.
Benjan shook his fist, just now realizing that he was saying all this out loud, after all. Probably not a smart move, but he couldn't stop himself.
Look, there's enough water in Gray's deep rock to make an ocean a meter deep all the way around the planet. That's enough to resupply the atmospheric loss,
easy, even without breaking up the rocks. Our designer plants are doing their jobs.
We have heard of these routine miracles.
And there can be belts of jungle soon. We've got mountains for climbing, rivers that snake, polar caps, programmed animals coming up, beautiful sunsets, soft summer storms, anything the human race wants. That's the vision we had when we started, Gray. And I'm damned if I'm going to let the Magican...
But the Magican can defend Ray, the interviewer said mildly. Benjon paused.
Oh, you mean...
Yes, the ever-hungry outer colonies. Surely, if Gray proves as extraordinary as you think, the rebellious colonies will attempt to take it. The man gave Benjon a broad, insincere smile. Dummy, it said. Don't know the real politics of this time, do you? He could see the logic. Earth had gotten soft, fed by a tougher empire that now stretched to the chilly preserve beyond Pluto. To keep their manicured lands clean and original, Earthers had burrowed underground, built deep cities there, and sent most manufacturing off-world. The real economic muscle now lay in the hands of the suppliers of fine rocks and volatiles, shipped on long orbits from the outers and the belt. These realities were hard to remember when your attention was focused on the details of making a fresh world. One forgot that appetites ruled, not reason. Benjon grimaced.
The Magican fight well. They are the backbone of the fleet, yes. Still, to give them a world...
Surely in time there will be others, the man said reasonably.
Oh? Why should there be? We can't possibly make Venus work, and Mars will take thousands of years more.
No, I meant built worlds. Stations. He snorted.
Live inside a can?
That's what you do, the man shot back.
I'm different.
Ah, yes. The interviewer bore in, lips compressed to a white line, and the 3Ds followed him, snouts peering. Benjon felt hopelessly outmatched.
And just how so? I'm a man chosen to represent
the shaping station, correct?
I'm of the breed who have always lived in and for the station.
Now that's what I'm sure our audience really wants to get into. After all, the moon won't be ready for a long time. But you, an ancient artifact practically, are more interesting.
I don't want to talk about that.
Stony, frozen. Why not? Not really a question.
It's personal.
You're here as a public figure.
Only because you require it. Nobody wants to talk to the station directly.
We do not converse with such strange machines.
It's not just a machine.
Then what is it?
An idea,
he finished lamely.
An ancient one.
How to tell them? Suddenly he longed to be back doing a solid, worthy job. Frying a jet in Gray's skies, pushing along the organic chemistry. The interviewer looked uneasy.
Well, since you won't go there, our time's almost up, and...
Again I am falling over Gray. Misty auburn clouds, so thin they might be only illusion, spread below the ship. They caught red as dusk fell. The thick air refracted 6 times more than Earth's, so sunsets had a slow-motion grandeur. The full palette of pinks and crimsons and rouge reds. I am in a ramjet. The throttle growl is unmistakable, lancing cleanly into the upper atmosphere. Straps tug and pinch me as the craft banks and sweeps, the smoothly wrenching way I like it. The stubby snout sipping precisely enough for the air's growing oxygen fraction to keep the engine thrusting forward. I probably should not have come on this flight. It is an uncharacteristic self-indulgence. But I could not sit forever in the station to plot and plan and calculate and check. I had to see my handiwork, get the feel of it, to use my body in the way it longed for. I make the ramjet arc toward Gray's night side. The horizon curves away, clean, hard, blue-white, and chung. I take a jolt as the first canister blows off the underbelly below my feet. Through a rear-view camera, I watched it tumble away into ruddy oblivion. The canister carries more organic cultures, a new matrix I selected carefully back on the station, in my expanded mode. I watch the shiny morsel explode below, yellow flash. It showers intricate, tailored algae through the clouds. Gray is at a crucial stage. Since the centuries ago slamming by the air-giving comets, the conspiracy of spin, water, and heat, great gifts of astro-engineering, had done their deep work. Volcanoes now simmered, percolating more moisture from deep within, kindling, kindling. Some heat climbed to the high cloud decks and froze into thin crystals. There I conjure fresh life, tinkering endlessly. Life, yes. Carefully engineered cells to breathe carbon dioxide and live off the traces of other gases, this high from the surface. In time. Photosynthesis in the buoyant forms. Gas bag trees, spindly but graceful in the top layer of Gray's dense air, conjure carbon dioxide into oxygen. I glance up, encased in the tight flight jacket, yet feeling utterly free. Naked. Incoming meteors. Brown clouds of dust I had summoned to orbit about Gray were cutting off some sunlight. Added spice, these ingredients sent from the asteroids to pepper the soil, prick the air, speed chemical matters along. The surface was cooling, the Gray greenhouse winding down. Losing the heat from the atmosphere's birth took centuries. Patience. Prudence. Now chemical concerts in the rocks slowed. I felt those, too, as a distant sampler hailed me with its accountant's chattering details. Part of the song. Other chem chores, more subtle, would soon become energetically possible. Fluids could seep and run. In the clotted air below, crystals and cells would make their slow work, all in time. In time, the first puddle had become a lake. How I had rejoiced then. Centuries ago, I wanted to go swimming in the clear blue seas of Luna, I remember. Tropical waters at the equator, under Earthshine. What joy it had been to fertilize those early still waters with minutely programmed bacteria, stir and season their primordial soup, and wait. What sweet Mother Earth did in a billion years, I did to Gray in 50. Joyfully. Singing the song of the molecules in concert with them. My steps were many, the methods subtle. To shape the mountain ranges, I needed further infalls from small asteroids, taking a century, ferrying rough-cut stone to polish a jewel. Memories of a man and more, fashioned from the tick of time, ironed out by the swift passage of mere puny years, of decades, of the ringing centuries. Worlds take time. My ramjet leaps into night, smelling of hot iron and chung, discharging its burden. I glance down at wisps of yellow pearl, sulfuric and carbolic acid streamers drifting far below. There algae feed and prosper. Murky mists below pale, darken, vanish, go. Yet I felt a sudden sadness as the jet took me up again. I had watched every small change in the atmosphere, played shepherd to newborn cloudbanks, raised fresh chains of volcanoes with fusion triggers that burrowed like moles. And all this might come to naught if it became another private preserve for some Earthside power games. I could not shake off the depression. Should I have that worried pruned away? It could hamper my work, and I could easily be rid of it for a while when I returned to the sleeping vaults. Most in the station spent about 1 month per year working, their other days passed in dreamless, chilled sleep,
waiting for the slow metabolism of Gray to quicken and change. Not I. I slept seldom, and did not want the stacks of years washed away. I run my tongue over fuzzy teeth. I am getting stale, worn. Even a ramjet ride did not revive my spirit. And the station did not want slackers. Not only memories could be pruned. Ancient urges arise, needs. A warm shower and rest await me above, in orbit, inside the mother's skin. Time to go. I touch the controls, cutting in extra ballistic computer capacity, and suddenly, I am there again, with her. She is around me and beneath me, slick with ruby sweat, and the power of it soars up through me. I reach out, and her breast blossoms in my eager hand. Her soft cries unfurl in puffs of green steam. She is a splash of purple across the cool, lunar stones, her breath ringing in me. As she licks my rasping ear with a tiny, jagged fork of puckered laughter, most joyful and triumphant, yea, verily. The station knows you need this now. Yes, and the station is right. I need to be consumed, digested, spat back out a new and fresh man, so that I may work well again. So she coils and swirls like a fine tinkling gas around me. Her mouth wraps me like a vortex. I slide my shaft into her gratefully as she sobs great racking orange gaudiness through me, her, again, her. Gift of the strumming, vast blue station that guides us all down centuries of dense, oily time. You need this. Take, eat. This is the body and blood of the station. Eat, savor, take fully. I had known her once, redly sweet and loud, and now I know her again. My senses all piling up and waiting to be eaten from her. I glide back and forth, moisture chimes between us. She is coiled tight, too. We all are, we creatures of the station. It knows this, releases us when we must be gone. I slam myself into her because she is both that woman, known so long ago, delicious in her whirlwind passions, supple in colors of the mind, singing in rubs and heats. I knew across the centuries. So the station came to know her, too, and duly recorded her, so that I can now bury my coal-black, sweaty troubles in her. And thus in the shaping station, as was and ever shall be, gray world without end. Amen.